Michael Goldfarb in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Childlessness, infertility, is the curse that keeps on giving. Every day is a day of mourning for a child that never was. 25 years ago today, news came that gave hope to infertile couples.
Officials at the General Hospital in Oldham, England, report that the world's first test tube baby, a 5-pound, 12-ounce girl, was born by cesarean section tonight. Both mother, 30-year-old Mrs. Leslie Brown, and the baby are reported in excellent condition after the delivery, which occurred shortly before midnight. A doctor at the hospital says the baby's condition at birth was normal.
Since the birth of Louise Brown, more than a million children around the world have been born via IVF. The advances in the practice of infertility treatment have marched hand in hand with advances in genetic science, so that a quarter century later we have reached a point where fertility treatments can satisfy more than the primal desire to have a child. Genetically selected offspring, lacking congenital diseases, or of a predetermined sex, are no longer science fiction, but a modern ethical dilemma. Connection listeners, we're marking Louise Brown's 25th birthday today. Science has opened new doors, so how far should couples go? How far would you go in the quest for healthy, happy children? How far should society go in establishing rules to govern people's reproductive choices? If medical science can guarantee you won't pass on a deadly disease to your child, should that even be a concern of legislators? You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me from a studio in Michigan is Dr. Mark Hughes. He's professor of molecular medicine and genetics at Wayne State University School of Medicine, and he's considered the pioneer of the pre-implantation genetic diagnosis in America. Hello, Dr. Mark Hughes.
Good morning.
Why don't we just begin at the beginning, and could you explain exactly how pre-implantation genetic diagnosis works?
Right. Well, the technology has now been around for almost 12 years, and basically it came about from a group of scientists and physicians who are quite upset about the fact that, in general, the field of genetics has sort of been diagnose and adios, because you make a diagnosis, you tell the family what it means, but there are generally no treatments or cures for many, many, many genetic disorders. And so what does a couple do when they're at this high genetic risk, either because they've been tested ahead of time with their own blood or because they've already have a child who's very, very sick or has died from one of these terrible disorders? And their options are not very many. They can elect not to have any children or any more children. They could go out and adopt, which is a wonderful option, and we should encourage that and actually make it a lot easier in this country, I think. They could throw the genetic dice and take a chance and have a prenatal test like a chorion villus sampling at about 10 weeks into the pregnancy, or an amniocentesis at about 16 weeks into the pregnancy, during which time they have incredibly high anxiety. These are not random events. These patients have a 1 in 4 or a 1 in 2 chance of having another baby with the disease. So it's not low risk. It's very high risk. So many of them are afraid to throw the dice. And so the technology came about with a really basically science fiction idea about 10, 11 years ago, was maybe we could, at least until there were cures for these disorders, offer these couples something other than throwing the dice and having an amnio and considering terminating a pregnancy. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of making the diagnosis before the couple ever got pregnant is where this came from, and that sounded pretty outrageous at the time. The idea was that we would take this perfectly fertile couple who's already had a child oftentimes, and we would pretend that they're infertile. They would go through the in vitro fertilization process like a million babies have now been born through, only they're perfectly fertile. And at the time that the eggs are collected and fertilized, instead of just transferring them back to the woman's womb, as would be done for IVF or infertility, instead we would take and let them grow in the incubator for 3 days so that they would go from one cell, the fertilized egg, to 2 cells, and then to 4, and then to 8 cells. At the 8-cell stage, this is still the same size as the original egg. The cells are still inside the egg shell, actually. So every time the cell divides, it has to get smaller in order to squish in. We take a little micro straw, a little micro pipette. That's 1/25th the diameter of a human hair. and we take and we biopsy one little cell from each of those fertilized eggs. The embryo goes safely back into the incubator as though the couple had a fertility problem, and the little cell goes to a reference laboratory where the DNA is tested to determine whether or not that cell and therefore that embryo would have the lethal disease of concern for that couple. The very next day, we know those results, and we call the clinic back and tell them which embryos are suitable for transfer that don't have the disease. And then the couple can begin their pregnancy on day one with a commitment to continuing it, and with the knowledge that it doesn't have this disease, without 16 weeks of anxiety while they're trying to decide what they're going to do if the dice rolled the wrong way. So the goal here was to try to develop something that would act as a stopgap until we had cures for these diseases. Of course, the goal is cure, absolutely, for all the disease foundations and societies, whether it's the cystic fibrosis or the muscular dystrophy or the Tay-Sachs. All these thousands of different genetic disorders, what these families all want is cures, and what all the scientists want is cures. But in the meantime, we've got many desperate families that throw dice and have to think about abortion,
right.
And they're afraid of that. And that's the basically the technology.
So basically what we're talking about now is we start the program by saying we're talking about this because of the anniversary we're celebrating today, but that the treatment of IVF, pioneered for infertile couples, now has applications for any couple trying to conceive. I'd like to bring into the conversation two patients of yours, Dr. Hughes, Gwyneth and Jeff Berkowitz, who live in New Hampshire, and I think they're on a phone line from their home. Hello?
Hi.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Okay. Now, you are not an infertile couple. You were able to conceive your own child, but you lost a daughter.
Yes.
To a genetically inherited disease.
Right. She has myotonic dystrophy.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually have it as well, but I didn't know I had it. I have very insignificant symptoms, and she was born with the congenital form, and it affected her greatly, and she wasn't able to breathe on her own, and she ended up passing away after only living for 5 weeks.
Now, when you had this tragedy, had you heard about Dr. Hughes? How did you find your way to his treatment?
I actually hadn't, you know, I had no idea that PGD ever existed, and my mom actually read something in a People magazine, and I went through the People magazine, found out doctors' names, I emailed them, and then they sent me to Dr. Hughes.
And tell us a bit about the treatment and about, and Dr. Hughes, you can jump in here as well. How do you counsel patients and bring them to a decision about going through with this procedure? Both of you at once or one at a time?
Gwen, go ahead.
Well, I know that we, you know, have a 50% chance of having another child like Logan, our daughter. And to me, it was just, you know, I don't want to go through that again. I don't want to have to, you know, live through another tragedy like it was. And since this technology is available, I'm going to try everything I can do to have another baby that's mine and my husband's. And, you know, since this is available, this is definitely something that I chose to do before, you know, deciding to adopt. If it, you know, eventually, you know, comes to that, if I do it a bunch of times and it just doesn't work, you know, before deciding anything else, I think that this was just a great, you know, opportunity.
Jeff Berkowitz, what did you feel about this?
I was very pleased that this was actually an option. I mean, once our daughter passed away, and we used the internet to really research all the different options and learn about myotonic dystrophy also, and when we found out about PGD as a possible option, we actually made a trip out to go visit Dr. Hughes in person, even though he was great on the phone and answered lots of our questions. But
what are the kinds of questions you asked him?
Safety, you know, Gwen's safety, you know, taking hormones, just what IVF does to the human body, and then, you know, what happens to the embryos that are sick and what you do with those. I mean, there was loads and loads of questions. I mean, we probably spoke to him at least 3 or 4 times and then, you know, physically flew out to Detroit to go visit with him in person and shake his hand and look in his eyes before we actually went forward with this.
And where are you in the process now?
We're actually in our third attempt. We've already done two cycles, and Gwen was actually able to get pregnant the first time around, but unfortunately had a miscarriage that had nothing to do with PGD or IVF. It was just, you know, the natural course of, you know, I think 20% of pregnancies actually end in miscarriage. And the second time just did not work, did not conceive, and the additional embryos that were left over, we weren't able to save those. They didn't continue to grow. And we actually just started this week with shots again for our third attempt.
Let me turn to Dr. Hughes. Now, one of the things, of course, about IVF is that while it offers hope, the success rates are only okay, and they're very related to age, as I think most listeners probably know. With your when you add in the PGD procedure, does that significantly alter the usual rates of success for IVF?
It depends on the disease. First of all, you're right. The age of the woman is the most critical factor because a woman's eggs are as old as she is plus a few months, whereas sperm is made new every day. Eggs get older as mom gets older. And as they do, they make mistakes when they are released. And so IVF success drops slowly, not precipitously, but drops slowly as mother gets older to where it's virtually unlikely to work by the time a woman is 40. Now, these couples tend not to be infertile. They're coming for IVF for an entirely different reason, a genetic reason. And they have great gametes. They have great eggs and great sperm, and they generally make wonderful embryos. So that part of the process actually works pretty well, as it has done for Gwen and Jeff. But they take a hit on the back end because in the case of myotonic dystrophy, half of their embryos, 50% of them, would be predicted to have this terrible lethal disease. And so sometimes they, when a couple goes through the process, they might make four embryos and two of them have disease, and the two that are capable of being transferred are not necessarily the best looking two that are most likely to implant and make the couple a baby. So for a recessive disease, a 1 in 4 chance, a disease like cystic fibrosis or Tay-Sachs or Gaucher or Canavan or on and on, lots of those kinds of diseases, mother and dad both have to carry a typographical error in their human genome, and then they both have to pass that down to the next generation. And there's a 1 in 4 chance of that, 50-50 for each parent. The egg has a 50-50 chance of having the mutation or the normal gene, and the sperm has a 50-50 chance.
Doctor,
and when you multiply 1/2 times 1/2, you get a quarter.
Dr.
So
Hughes,
for a yes.
I'm sorry, I'm going to have to interrupt you simply because we're coming to the end of the segment. And I just wanted to quickly turn to Gwen and Jeff and say, you're going for a third shot. What happens if it doesn't work this time?
I think we're just going to reassess. I can tell you that it's a very expensive process because we're not covered by insurance because we are fertile. And, you know, maybe try naturally and have those tests done, although that's something that really does frighten me to, you know.
Well, we wish you, we hope the third time is the lucky one for both
Thank
of you.
You.
And
Thank
good
you.
Luck
Thank
to you,
you.
Both.
Thanks.
Connection listeners, we're talking about recent advances in fertility treatments, genetic screening. It's the 25th anniversary of the birth of the first test tube baby. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK to join in the conversation. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. We're talking in this hour, listeners, about recent advances, the marriage of genetic science and in vitro fertilization techniques. It's the 25th anniversary of the birth of Louise Brown, the world's first, as they said then, test tube baby. I don't think people would use that term much anymore. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK to join in the conversation. We're talking with Dr. Mark Hughes, who's professor of molecular medicine and genetics at Wayne State University. And I'd like to bring into the conversation now Dr. Jared McGill, who's executive director of the center and department chair of the PhD program in healthcare ethics at St. Louis University. And he joins us from the studios of our sister station, KWMU in St. Louis. Hello, Dr. McGill.
Good morning.
Now, you know why we're doing this program. It's the 25th anniversary of the birth of Louise Brown. Are you surprised that there's been less of a fuss made? This is a major milestone in scientific history, isn't it?
Yeah, I was disappointed reading this morning's papers to see how little reporting of the 25th anniversary had been covered. I was actually living in Britain 25 years ago when Louise Brown was born, as you can tell by my accent. And it was certainly a major story then and has been since. I'm very glad to be on this show to discuss some of the ethical dimensions of this technology, especially when it's being applied to the more modern opportunities of genetic disease.
Well, let's talk about these ethical dimensions. They were there from the start, weren't they? Or are there new ones that have emerged?
Well, yes, there are new technologies that have emerged. 25 years ago, the breakthrough was the famous test tube baby with Louise Brown. And as Dr. Hughes has said, over the past decade, the new opportunities have developed aligned to that technology, using the technology in this particular case with regard to trying to track genetic disease prior to implantation so that the embryo would grow without that disease. That's a fairly major breakthrough of about 10 years standing, but of recent times it has become much more to the fore of media discussion and ethics. And I'm here, I guess, today to discuss the ethics dimensions about which I have some serious concerns.
Okay, what are those concerns?
Well, it's interesting that Jeff, the husband you were discussing this case with, he actually identified the concerns when you asked him about some of the counselling questions prior to their decision. He identified the question of safety for his wife in terms of the hormones that she has to take. There's obviously the safety to the little embryo when the ones that are selected are implanted. There are many studies out of very recent times demonstrating that there are risks not only to the mother but also to the little embryos growing, more significant risks than would be in the natural process. So that's one aspect. We have to seriously look at the safety of the process, and that raises an important ethical and regulatory dimension. The second aspect that Jeff identified is also very important. What do we do with the sick embryos, that is, with the embryos that are diagnosed with the genetic disease? The answer is they are simply destroyed. They are discarded. And for many people, that creates a serious problem in the sense of respecting human life.
Okay,
There's no need for us, of course, to debate when life begins, but everyone agrees that embryos are human life, and that creates a problem for many.
Let me ask Dr. Mark Hughes to come back on these points. Risk to the embryo, is that, I mean, that's obviously a concern of yours. The ethical dimension of that, Mark Hughes?
Well, initially when this technology was being developed, that was our biggest concern, which is could you take a cell from the embryo with this little micro straw without hurting it? Of course, it had been done tens of thousands of times in other mammals like mice and sheep and cows, and it obviously wasn't harming them. That was large numbers, but it had not been done in humans before. The arguments that we had were basically you could distill them down into several, but I think one of the most persuasive is that Mother Nature, all by herself, without any doctors anywhere nearby, does this biopsy business all by herself. Because when you have an identical twin, it starts with a single egg and sperm and starts to divide 2, 4, 8, 16 cells. And right around that stage of development, Mother Nature takes as much as half of those cells, not just one, but as much as half of them, breaks them away. They float across the womb to the other side and create a separate individual who's genetically identical to the original one. So it's not the removal of one cell, it's the removal of multiple ones. But also, this has been done now for more than a decade, and surprisingly, when you do follow-up studies on the babies that are born, the background risk of having a birth defect in any couple out there, any of the listeners, can be as high as 3 to 5%, and babies are born every day with kidney defects and heart defects and spina bifida and cleft lips and things like that. And we see that all the time in the children's hospital, but the risks that we've seen with PGD are less than that, which only is statistics, obviously. It's clearly doesn't – no one would suggest that the biopsy is somehow protective. But it just doesn't show any evidence at all in a worldwide now – evaluations of this, but I think better studies need to be done, and I think Dr. McGill is absolutely right. We need controlled, randomized, prospective, as they always say, studies to evaluate these sorts of things. Of course, that requires funding by agencies that would do such a thing. And in general, in the United States, that's been blocked.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Adrian is calling from Wellesley, Massachusetts.
Hello. I teach bioethics at Wellesley College, particularly these topics of reproductive issues. And I'd like to say that there are so many ethical questions about both IVF and prenatal and PGD that really need to be discussed. Safety is certainly one, but there are concerns about the difference between the desire for a child and the desire for a particular child. As Dr. Evans just said, 3 to 5% of children are born with congenitally diagnosable conditions, and they live often very well with those disabilities. While it makes a lot of sense that people want to know whether their children might have a disability, it doesn't necessarily make sense to say that if they will have a disability, they shouldn't be born. And PGD can be used and is being used for things that are not immediately lethal, but for many conditions with which people can have very satisfying lives.
I can see how this conversation is going. All these things are going to root back to you, Dr. Mark Hughes. In your counseling, do you deal with these ethical questions, something that similar to what Adrian has just brought up?
Well, of course. Although I'm not a bioethicist and I don't pretend to be one, I try to practice bioethics in the science that we do. I think that the issue, and I bet Dr. McGill will come right to this in a cogent manner, but the issue is that few people might argue that trying to avoid a disease like the Berkowitzes have, where their child lives a few days or weeks, is quite different from using a technology like this for something trivial, say gender selection, for example. And we won't do gender selection, and most programs will not do it, but there are a few that will. And the question is, do you make public policy around the renegade Raelians who flail their arms and beat their chests and make all kinds of noise about things? I don't know the answer, but I do know that there are ethical issues about how the technology is used and how you would bring this from the bench, research bench, to the bedside in a responsible manner. But gender is one that bothers me a lot. I didn't go into medicine or into science to do anything but diagnose and cure disease, and the last time I checked, your gender wasn't a disease, and so we don't feel that it has any appropriate place in this field.
Adrian?
May I make a couple of more comments?
Sure, Adrian.
Well, I certainly, Dr. Hughes, I'm sorry I misnamed you. I think that certainly gender is not a disease or disability, but I'd like to point out that cystic fibrosis, Gaucher's disease, muscular dystrophy are not immediately lethal. They are conditions with which people can live for quite a long time and have very satisfying lives. And so while they may count as disabilities under the Americans with Disabilities Act, that's certainly something to think about. I think they also are or could be in the a more gray area than many people believe them to be.
For sure.
The other comment I would like to make it is that we have woefully few studies of the psychosocial impact of IVF, ARTs, prenatal testing on families and the children who result. It's astonishing how little we know about the social lives and the psychological impact of being produced by these technologies. And I think that should be a great concern of the people who use these technologies and the people who create them and support them and promote them.
Adrian, thank you for your comments. I want to bring Jared McGill back into the conversation. Dr. McGill, do you want to pick up on any of Adrian's points?
Yes, I would very much like to, Michael. I think Adrian identified perhaps the most crucial issue in this debate from the point of view of the value of human life when she says that having a disability should not itself be a selection criterion for not being born. And perhaps the greatest fault line that Dr. Hughes has to face from the point of view of ethics is trying to defend that that position that selecting the embryos that have no disease is a morally better thing to do than permitting nature to take its course and allow people with disability. In other words, there is an underlying agenda that if we have a technological capacity to remove disease, that we must do that at all costs, independent of risk and independent of the social ramifications that entail embracing disability and dealing with disability rather than trying to pretend we can simply overcome it, because we know that that will always be beyond the reach of the humankind.
Dr. Hughes.
Well, I agree, although I must say the definition of medicine is identifying disease and stopping it, if possible, in its tracks. And whether you are giving a newborn a vaccination or you're taking somebody to open heart surgery or giving them a kidney transplant or any intervention in medicine, whether it's in pediatrics or gerontology, involves the interruption of the normal course of nature. That's what we do in medicine. By definition.
I'd like to intervene, Dr. Hughes, to test that thesis, because I think you're correct, but it needs to be qualified. In other words, as a doctor, you could address that thesis very well just simply by killing all your patients. You would immediately stop the disease they have. So the point of stopping disease in ethics is not just that you stop or prevent the disease, it's that you do it in a balanced manner, that the burden and the benefit of the intervention is justified. And in this case of PGD, we are talking from the point of view of ethics, that there are not only safety concerns, not the safety concerns that you raise, because I think you're right, from the antecedent perspective of animal studies, the actual testing intervention seems to be reasonably safe. But the safety concerns I have are about the actual growth of the selected embryo. There are many studies out there that tell us that the technology of IVF for PGD babies yields far greater risks about their developing safely. And I'm wondering how you explain that to the parents who are looking for a so-called safe baby. Do they understand that the actual technology of IVF using pre-implantation genetic diagnosis actually raises the risks not just of the mother but also of ailments in the baby? Do they understand that they may be embracing a different kind of disability, in other words?
Well, I mean, that makes a lot of assumptions, that question, doesn't it, Dr. McGill? Because, as we've already pointed out in the program, there haven't been these kinds of studies, longitudinal studies of, you know, the million-odd children who've been born via IVF, who would be all younger than 25. So we don't really know yet whether, you know, through a normal process of living, they are more susceptible to certain kinds of diseases.
But I think you do know of the studies that have been published over the past 2 to 3 years, 2002, 2003, in very prominent journals such as The Lancet and the Journal of Urology and so on, that are obstetrics and gynecology, that are indicating double the risk of birth defects for this procedure. Or very seriously increased risks for preeclampsia. In other words, while there are many more studies that need to be done, over the past several years there have been sufficient publications in the highly respected scientific journals indicating that there are very substantively increased risks to the growing embryo as well as to the mother using this technology. Yeah. So it's that safety issue that I think still needs to be addressed very carefully.
Mark Hughes, do you read those studies?
That's just simply not so. There are concerns. There's no question about that. There are concerns about IVF in general. I don't think that the issue is so much PGD. We were talking a minute ago about selection of genes and whether that's ethical or not. But the reality of it is that embryos have been selected one over another for transfer to the woman's womb for those 25 years. The best-looking embryos in the clinic of the obstetrician, I happen not to be an obstetrician, but they pick the best-looking ones and put them back. And they've done that by simply looking at them under a microscope and saying, well, this one looks like it's growing better than that one and more likely to make this desperate family a healthy baby. Now we've changed the bar and we're measuring DNA instead of just visualizing them. But the selection process is essentially selecting, and some are transferred and some are frozen and some are not. And I have a problem understanding. I understand the issues of the large number of folks who feel that that fertilized egg has the same ethical value as the toddler who's playing in your backyard. If you have that feeling, then you should be upset about IVF in general, not just PGD. And I think most of those people are. But I don't think that PGD in and of itself is raising that many new ethical issues with regards to selection. It, where it's raising the new issues is in what is a disease and what is a trait and who decides such a thing. We're going to have some body that decides that, and who would that be? For example, you know, it's interesting. I learned recently, I gave a talk at Columbia, and I learned that in the Jewish faith, the fertilized egg has absolutely no ethical value at all. None. Not until 40 days in the mother's womb does it have any value. And I understand, although I'm not an expert in religion, that Islam is the same. So in a pluralistic society that we live in, one has to ask the question, how are you deciding what's right and wrong based on these kinds of issues? I don't know what's right and wrong, and I think that that's why we need experts like Dr. McGill involved in the discussions, for sure. And the caller earlier brought that up as well. I think diseases and traits, they're different. And how do you draw the line? And they move. This line moves. 10 years ago, the very first PGD ever done for a disease was for cystic fibrosis. Back then, no children were ever able to have their own because they were dead from cystic fibrosis before they got to reproductive age. Now, the treatments for this disease are markedly better, wonderfully so. It has moved from a terrible, terrible disorder to not nearly as bad as it was then, and hopefully we'll have pure cures. So in this transition period of time, how do you decide that this is an appropriate one to select for a disease or not? And the couple could go and have an amniocentesis and terminate a 15-week fetus legally. So the issue really comes down to avoiding that, I think.
Connection listeners, we're talking in this hour about the rights and wrongs that of the ethical questions raised by the possibility of in vitro fertilization. It's a process that brings hope to thousands and thousands of couples, but it also raises very keen issues, and keen issues for the future because it's now wedded to advances in genetic science as well. 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, to join in the conversation. What is right? What is wrong? I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. We're talking in this hour about the ethical issues raised by the advances in fertility and genetic science. They've come together, and things that were undreamable 25 years ago are reality today. We're talking with Dr. Mark Hughes, who's professor of molecular medicine and genetics at Wayne State University, and Dr. Jared McGill, who is the executive director of the center and department chair of the PhD program in healthcare ethics at St. Louis University. Just before the break, Dr. Hughes was quite passionately defending what he does, raising important questions about what's right and wrong in the procedures. A very specific point that people born with cystic fibrosis prior to the development of his particular techniques didn't live long enough to have children. Now you have the option of removing, in a sense, the gene that causes that and giving people a full life, but then they pass it on. These are important ethical questions. I want to give you, Dr. Jared McGill, a chance to come back to what Dr. Hughes was saying just before the break.
Well, thank you, Michael. I have identified the two ethical issues so far that Jeff, the husband, even identified, the safety of the embryo selected and the wife, as well as the what to do with the sick embryos. But there are two other ethical questions that are worth bearing in mind. And the first is the one identified actually by Dr. Hughes when he said he would not use this technology for trivial issues such as the selection of gender. Now, I certainly applaud his effort at trying to attend to and overcome disease. And of course, that admission of not doing it for other things like gender selection, which he attributes as trivial, indicates that he has a selection criterion, and that's important. In other words, the very task that he has given himself as a doctor to intervene with disease and to resolve it or cure it has always got to be qualified in the sense of it's got to be done in a balanced perspective. It's not just at any cost. Let me give you an example of how any cost could work to demonstrate how fickle our human condition can be. I mean, isn't it interesting, in the last 50 years of the last century, we celebrated contraception where we were having babies we were having sex without babies. And then at the very beginning of the third millennium, as we had the possibility of cloning, we started to have try to have babies without sex. Now, those kind of conundrums, that's a comical way of demonstrating the fickle capacity of the human spirit. But there is no doubt that the technology that Dr. Hughes is referring to, while he may be using it in as honourable a fashion as he can do, although I would like to have some concerns still about the safety issues he mentioned based on recent reliable scientific studies published about the safety of the embryo as well as the mother, there is no doubt that that technology is not under his control. There are people out there who want to use it for gender selection and for other purposes. But that's why I think from an ethics point of view, we do need to have some kind of regulation about this.
I understand that, but to be truthful, I mean, in virtually any new advance in science, there are unscrupulous people who have the knowledge and will use it. I mean, it doesn't have to just be related to bioethics. I mean, we all sit at home bemoaning email that we don't want, and that's a misuse of a technology. I think that's just inherent in new technology, don't you?
And you agree that regulation is needed to sort of sidestep those problems and solve those problems?
Only if it's a big enough problem. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Jane is calling from Boston, Massachusetts.
Hi.
Hi, Jane.
I just wanted to join the conversation with a little bit of experience of having gone through PDG. And the reason that we chose to do it as a family was had nothing to do with selection. And although I totally appreciate the ethical conversation, and obviously it needs to be had and continue to be had, as you point out, with any new technology, I think you can't deny that the people who have gone through this, myself included, infertility is a disease, and you wouldn't deny new technology and new treatments in cancer, for instance, or in spina bifida, in things that we're discussing. And This is a way for people to get around this disease until it can be cured within the mother or the father. And we had no ethical concerns about it because our embryos were being selected not for any particular trivial trait, as you point out, for sex, but for something that was going to stop me from miscarrying that I had been doing several times. And I think, I guess I just want to put back into it the wrenching emotion that parents go through to get to the point, and then what a godsend this technology has been.
Jane, how old is your child?
8 months.
8 months. And healthy?
Unbelievably.
Well, that's great.
It's just been an incredible blessing, and I can't say enough about how where we were 2 years ago emotionally and where we are now. It's like being cured.
Jane, I want to thank. Who's that in the background?
That would be my offspring.
Jane, I want to thank you for your call. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Sasha is calling from Boston.
I'd like to commend Dr. Hughes for his efforts and the work that he is doing. I am a parent who has lost a child to a genetic disease at 6 months of age, and watching her go through the pain and suffering that she went through was just the most horrific, horrific experience in my life. I'm blessed to have a healthy little girl now, but if he is able to offer people an option so that they aren't faced with difficult decisions, and I know that fertility treatment is also very stressful, but I commend him for doing the work that he's doing, because there are parents who deserve to be parents, and I think he's great.
Sasha, let me ask you, what about regulation, though? I mean, do you think that this is an area that might well need some regulation?
Most definitely. Most certainly. And there are, you know, there are different diseases carry different levels of severity. And so it's hard to say which diseases you should be able to test for and which diseases you shouldn't be able to test for. And it is a judgment call on the quality of life that one child may have with one disease as opposed to another. And some diseases are fatal. You know, my daughter was lucky that she lived until she was 6 months old, but other children with her disease, you know, die within 48 hours after birth. And so it is hard to quantify and qualify.
Okay.
So regulation is important.
All right. Sasha, I want to thank you for your call and stay with us, because I'm going to put this to both of my doctor guests, Dr. Mark Hughes and Dr. Jared McGill. Can we try and get some common ground on what kind of regulation would work that wouldn't impede science and that would be ethical? Dr. Hughes.
Actually, I think we have complete common ground. I'm in 100% agreement with the caller and with Dr. McGill that we need some kind of regulation. So that's not the issue. I think we're all in agreement. The question is, who would do it? And I think Dr. McGill's home country has led the world, not only in IVF, but in the way in which you move it forward in a responsible way while you watch it and nurture it and make sure that it isn't abused. And they have a panel, a council there, that reviews these kinds of situations and licenses the clinics that do it and monitors it carefully. And it would be wonderful if we had the ability in the United States to have such a thing. The problem, of course, is that as soon as you start to talk about embryos and reproduction, you raise the entire ire of lots of people with regards to when life begins. And there isn't a politician in their right mind that wants to get too close to that, because half of the populace that votes will be on the opposite side of whatever side they choose. And so we have been stymied in this country, and it's very frustrating. We've been stymied in terms of not regulation with sticks, but also regulations with carrots. How do we take these kinds of technologies and move them? I mean, technology is the engine that drives science, and science is the fuel that propels medicine. And over again, medicine pushes us into the bioethical corner about how do we do this appropriately.
Dr. McGill?
Well, I think Dr. Hughes raises the right point. We are in agreement that that regulation is very important. This is a breakthrough technology. It's dealing with the most sacred aspect of human life, both in terms of the meaning of life, that is an embryo, and diseased life in terms of the future development of safe human beings. Also, I think Dr. Hughes puts his finger on a very important point, and I share his skepticism that politics will avoid the issue in terms of ascertaining when life begins. He mentions Great Britain's panel and council for licensing. But the only reason Britain's been able to, I think, lead the world in terms of sound regulation of these very controversial issues is because the politicians decided to take the issue in hand and ascertain for a democratic society the question of when life begins. Now, of course, people can argue about that decision. Our country has seriously lacks that capacity at the moment. In other words, our politicians have not yet fessed up to the plate as elected members of our democratic society to deal with that question about when life begins and what the meaning of early life is. Because until they do so, I'm afraid that scientists like Dr. Hughes and many other researchers are going to be constantly stymied and frustrated in terms of how they can get federal funds and so on for what might be or not be legitimate research.
Dr. McGill,
so
in
those
look,
two issues, I think...
In St. Louis, I just want to interject here, you know, that perhaps it's time for the advocacy groups to step 10 giant steps backwards and allow serious ethicists and scientists to debate these issues and present intelligent comments to Congress. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Lee is calling from Natick, Massachusetts.
Hi. It's interesting that you said advocacy groups should speak up, because I volunteer for Resolve, the National Infertility Association. I also have a cherished 3-year-old daughter from IVF, and I know dozens and dozens of families that have been made whole through the wonders of medical treatment with assisted reproduction. My feeling is that I'm very skittish about regulation. From what I have seen, we parents and we couples who want to be parents care fervently about the health and safety of the babies that we are bringing to life. And we, in partnership with our doctors can be trusted to make good, sound decisions. I don't want a politician in Washington telling me how many eggs can be fertilized, how many embryos can be transferred, what has to be done with any additional embryos I might have. As a parent, lovingly helping, using medical treatment to have a family, I believe that I can be trusted in those decisions.
Lee, we're coming to the end of the hour, and I just want to put your comment to Dr. Hughes, who presumably is still looking for ways of improving his own techniques that he's been developing over the last 10, 15 years.
Well, actually, I was asked recently where I'd like to see this field in 10 years, and my answer was simple. I'd like to see that it's obsolete, because I'd like to have cures for these diseases. That's really what we need, as I said at the outset of the program. But as the callers who've called in have said, I mean, basically, this is family building. This is taking desperate families and helping them, whether they're infertile or whether they have a serious genetic disease, and helping them have a healthy family. If that isn't American, I don't know what is. But most of these families are not looking for a perfect child. They know there's no such thing. Their parents know it perfectly well that there's no such thing. The goal here is for them to have a child in which the A and the T and the G and the C, the four letters of the genetic alphabet, are okay in the single gene that we're concerned about in their family. This is not cloning. This is not gene enhancement. This is not changing genes in a eugenic manner. This is simply trying to avoid serious disease until cures come along. We've done that in a competent way with heart transplantation in this country as well. When it first came out, people said, oh, my God, organ transplantation is incredibly expensive technology. We shouldn't be wasting our precious research dollars and healthcare dollars on such high-tech things that are only going to be available to the rich. Okay. And we're going to be reduced to our component parts if we have all these kidney and heart transplants.
Mark, I'm going to have to interrupt you there because we're coming to the end of the show. I'd just like to say that there's a quality of it was ever thus with advancements in medical science that new treatments have many, many, many critics, and then they become common and everyday. Thank you, Dr. Mark Hughes. Thank you also to Dr. Gerald McGill at St. Louis University. Earlier we spoke with Gwyneth and Jeff Berkowitz. Thanks to all our callers. A show like this, more calls than we can possibly get to. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection.